Scott Bassenecker, and episode 2 of our podcast is going to focus on gangs. Are there things that we have to learn from gangs? What if we gave the microphone to some gang members and had them speak to us? Are there things we can learn? Gangs are a growing reality here in the U.S. The National Gang Intelligence Center prepared a 2011 report that said that there's 1.4 million members of gangs in the U.S., and that roughly half the violent crime in America is due to violent gangs. I happen to know Ivan Paz, who is a former member of the Bulldog Gang in Fresno, California, a large gang, interesting gang, no hierarchy, no clear leadership, and so a very difficult gang to address as a law enforcement officer, but a gang that's quite easy to enter in. So there are like 1,400 Bulldog members in Fresno, and Ivan was one of them, and to a certain extent continues to consider himself part of that reality. Just the fabric of relationships is so deep that even though Ivan did 5 years in prison and became a believer, started following Jesus, and in some respects stepped away from gang life, there are ways in which he's still very much connected to the friendships and the network inside gangs. He now runs the Pink House along with his wife, Beth Paz, and together they introduce youth to the complexities and challenges and beauty of life among those who are on the outside or cut off from resources. My interview was conducted over Skype, so you'll have to excuse some Skype foibles in the middle of it, but I think you'll find what Ivan has to say really interesting. Ivan's parents came from Central America. His mom came from El Salvador in the late 70s due to political violence in that country. And his dad came from Mexico due to extreme poverty there. They came and had Ivan and his three siblings and started a life here. A lot of people came and went out of their household. They tried to get them on their feet. And Ivan talks about those days and the hopes and dreams he had in the early days until his dad was carted off to prison and how things changed after that.
As a child, I had big dreams. I had a big imagination. And so my biggest dream, Scott, was to work for Disney. Because when I was in the second grade, a lot of my teachers and relatives were already realizing that I had the gift of drawing. So I can draw like crazy good. And so my biggest dream was to become an artist for Disney and create the first animated movie that involved a Latino character. And part of that was because I always thought that one of my favorite, you know, Disney movies was Aladdin. And I always thought Aladdin was Latino or Mexican. Until my cousins were like, no, fool, he's not Latino. He's freaking Indian, you know? And I was just like, oh, man. So it kind of crashed my world. So I told myself, I will one day become an artist for Disney. And then my dad got arrested not too long after those dreams. And he got arrested for being undocumented. And I just remember him putting me on his lap with my siblings. There was a giving us kisses, and there was a knock on the door, and there was some like federal agents that came, picked them up, and then my dad was gone. And so this put my mom in a difficult position where she had to work two jobs, and I didn't see her very much, and our house was sometimes a mess because, you know, we had a lot of families there, and everybody was working like really hard. And my older brother would be the one who was taking care of us. But he was in high school and he was caught up in his own drama. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of monitoring going on. When my dad left, when my dad returned years later, he was just a lot more messed up. So he was a raging alcoholic, would come once a week. he would beat my mom. And then after about a year of that, I think I was about 10 at this point, I found out that he had other children with a different woman, and which was the reason he was showing up once a week. And so I told myself, whenever I see my dad, I'm going to fight him. And so he would come home, and we would just get into these brawls. And, of course, I was 10 years old, so I didn't really do much to him. But he eventually grew in his shame. You know, family found out that he was being very abusive, and he decided to disappear. And something interesting happened. When my dad disappeared, I also ran away. So I remember when I first ran away, I think I was, by this time, after all that drama, I was about 12 years old, ran away. My mom did not want to call the police because everybody in the house was undocumented. And so she would pray every night and cry out to God and ask, like, God, like, protect my son. But I was out there roaming the streets, got involved with the certain people, started selling drugs. Got expelled from school, was in juvenile hall the first time when I was 12. They didn't even know what to do with me because I was so young. Got incarcerated again when I was 14, again when I was 16. And by that time, I was pushing a lot of drugs. I was already all tatted up with tattoos, and I was heavily involved in the drama of the neighborhoods. And so, I mean, I think if I can reduce the themes in my life to one thing when I was growing up, it would be gang violence. So I was really trapped in a cycle of gang violence that led me to an 8-year sentence to a state penitentiary when I was 19 years old.
Ivan talked about what it looked like and felt like to grow up in a depressed area and how that affected his sense of self. Just that understanding that you were desperate, and as other people brought charity, how that contributed to a sense of being other and of being less. And he talks about incidences where charitable individuals sort of played into this narrative of being undignified.
I think one of the hard things was like the poverty. The poverty made me feel very ashamed. I remember my mom would take us to churches that didn't there's two of them that really stand out to me. But I remember one time we were standing in a long line, and I put my hoodie over my head, and I was super ashamed that we were, like, standing in this, I don't know, I can't remember if it was a evangelical church or a Catholic church, but it was cold, it was foggy, and there was a lot of families out there, and I was just so, like, embarrassed that I was in this line.
They're handing stuff out.
Yeah, they were just basically giving out handouts during Christmas. There was another situation, too, when my dad was incarcerated. There was a certain ministry. I won't mention a name, but there was a certain ministry that would do this kind of, like, you know, connecting with families. And I just remember, like, this very white family showing up to my house with bags full of gifts. And they just, like, stepped into our living room, and they were great people and amazing. But I remember I was kind of hiding by the dining room area. I was just so embarrassed. Like, and I don't think at the time, if you would have asked me, like, what was happening in my heart, I don't know if I could put my finger on it, but I think I just felt like totally, like, we're Mexican, we're Salvadoran, and we're poor, and, like, here's this white family, they're better than us, and I should be ashamed of who I am, you know? So there's this kind of, like, weird feeling I got, and I think at that age, like between 10 years old and then knowing, like, also when I would go, I remember one time going to a friend's house who was white, and he had his own room, and that was a big deal for me, because when you would come to my house, my room was in the living room along with two other beds in the living room, and I felt very embarrassed that my living situation, the neighborhood I grew up in, there was all these kind of, like, I don't know, like, internalized stereotypes that I was very ashamed of.
Ivan talks about the somewhat redemptive nature of the gang that he got involved with in terms of restoring some sense of pride, some sense of dignity. And there's an interesting set of dynamics that goes on with gang loyalty and gang love and gang life. And Ivan talks about those three L's. I have a friend who really believes that if he laid down his life for the church, that the church really wouldn't take care of his family. Whereas if he laid down his life for a gang or for the mafia, the mob would look out for the family. And he says he doesn't have that sense of security with the church. So there's this interesting dynamic of a gang loyalty that I wonder if there's something beautiful and redemptive about that needs to be learned by the church. And Ivan talks about that relationship that he has to this day with some of the gang members who really laid down their lives for him.
I don't know if you remember Home Alone, but I remember that was like, I remember looking at Macaulay Culkin and was like, we're probably the same age, but I remember looking at him and saying like, you know, he's a good looking kid. Everybody loves him. America loves him. He's white. He's blonde, blue eyes, red lips. And then I would look in the mirror and I would see, you know, basically, I sometimes saw myself as like an indigenous person from the jungle. And I'm like, oh man, this is ugly. This is not cool. One interesting thing was, when I ran away from home and I started plugging in with some of the people from the community, who were selling drugs or gangbanging, they made me feel so great, Scott. Like, their skin was brown, they had tattoos, they lived in the same neighborhood, and they like literally like waved their ethnicity, their poverty, their hoodness, their ghetto-ness. They raised it up like a flag and made it something made it something to be proud of. And I think at this point, I feel like I unclothed myself from all of my shame. I took it off. I threw it away. And I said, there's no reason for me to feel that way. I am somebody. I am something to be proud of. I am a person of the hood, person of the ghetto. And it almost felt like anybody who did not match that criteria were kind of like less than. And so, I mean, today we could look at that and say, you know, it was a defense mechanism or, you know, an antithetical type of complex of some sort. But it was a real experience, and it brought me joy, and it brought me pride. And I think it brought me a lot of dignity. It reclothed me, so to speak. And so that, and then the relationships that were, I mean, there's a whole system there, you know. When I hung out with them, it wasn't just like one day I hung out with them, the next day I was a gang member. It was like a series of events where relationships were built, and I witnessed the loyalty of my buddies and their care for me. And to this day, I still consider them family. I never really left the gang, you know. And I never call myself a dropout. That has a lot of strings attached to that can be negative. But I did retire from gangbanging, if you want to use that term. And my connections with the gang is still pretty strong, which is the reason I can have them come over and speak to my students. There's been times where I've told them, leave the gun in your car, do not bring that into this environment, and they respect it, you know? And so
That sense of connection lives mm-hmm. on to this day. Your sense of that maybe belonging is different, but that sense of relational love with your gang members is still alive with some of them today?
Yes. I usually in my workshop I refer to this as the three L's. Love, love, loyalty, and life. And what I mean by that is love, there's like a very serious love for the geography, like the literal geography of the neighborhood, because it's attached to our identities. That neighborhood block, that area, that space, that urban space contains stories, and it is attached to who we are. And a lot of us fought and bled for that area. And then number two, loyalty. It's like there's this strong sense of relationship that where people are willing to lay down their lives for you. My friend Patrick got shot in the back for me. My friend, my other friend, well, three of them actually, but Arson, J-Dog, and Quiet, they got really beat down by like 20 dudes for me. And they did it. Can you imagine like three guys standing up to about 20 dudes just because they were looking for me? And they said that I got to watch my back. And my three friends, knowing that that they were going to get beat up, they stood up and they, you know, they shot disrespectful terms back at them, which is why they got beat down. But there's a sense of loyalty. Like we stand for each other and we sacrifice our lives for one another. And then third, there's a commonality. Like we live in community. My house and Lance's house used to be like the hub for our gang, and people would come in without knocking. We would share, you know, weed, money, other things you don't need to know about. But we shared a lot of things, and sometimes I wonder, like, these three little like values that oftentimes are embraced by other gangs are things that the church should be embracing. Geography, you know, loyalty to relationships, and commonality, you know, and sadly but truly, that is a difficult thing to do with churches. And yet gangs have become very successful in the neighborhoods because they operate under those three L's.
So law enforcement in Fresno, California has faced quite a challenge with the Bulldog Gang. When there's no real hierarchy, it's hard to know how to bring a gang like the Bulldogs under control. And when violence just seems to be multiplying, you're challenged to figure out how to bring about some kind of restraint of this terror that's occurring. So one law enforcement effort in Fresno was reaching out to gang members for those who were disenfranchised and wanting to leave the Bulldogs and get them from gang to work, an operation that I think has met with some success, and I really applaud that. But there's another pulse through many law enforcement agencies to meet violence and terror with another kind of violence and terror. And Ivan talks a bit about how that effort, a kind of terrorization of the Bulldog Gang, pushed him deeper into this place of absolute hatred for the police and entrenched his life in the Bulldogs, at least for a season.
So when I was 16 years – actually, I was 15 years old. I was hanging out with the homeboys, right, in the neighborhood, selling drugs, partying, everything you could think of. I basically wasn't a gang member, official gang member yet, but I was what you would call like not a wannabe, but like someone who backs them up, who's basically a loyalist, but hasn't gone through the initiation process. And but I was I think for almost a year I was heavily considering it, getting jumped into the Bulldog Gang. And if you want to know more about the Bulldogs, you can find a video from Gangland. Probably on YouTube. But I just remember one time we were walking back from the store. It was about 15 of us. We were walking from the neighborhood liquor store to the park. And I mean, all we bought was like munchies and stuff like that. But in Fresno, we have what is called MAGIC, which is a gang task force for the Fresno Police Department. And I mean, I just remember growing up, like we would say F the police and like all that. And I mean, I just followed along with the culture, right? It's the youth culture. We just like, you know, F the cops, who cares, don't be a snitch, all this stuff. But I remember that day when I was walking back from the liquor store with my friends, MAGIC pulled up. They jumped out of their cars, yelling at us, telling us to get down. They had bulletproof vests on, big boots, shotguns in their hands. And they weren't even looking for anybody. They just saw a group of about 15 young teenagers. Yes, a lot of them had the gang colors on and all that stuff. but it almost felt like they were gangbanging on us. They jumped out of their car, and I was holding onto my bike, and I just felt like there's no reason why I need to, you know, get down on the ground. This is ridiculous. While all my friends got down, I just told them, I said, I don't need to get down. I haven't done anything. And they just ransacked me, Scott. They threw me on the floor. And one of the officers, he grabbed my arm and he pulled it way behind my back. And I got friends that are cops. So I got a lot of respect for police. And I would not say that all cops are abusive or anything. But I remember he pulled my arm so high up that it felt like it was going to rip. And it actually did tear a little bit. I went to the hospital afterwards. But he pulled it up and my immediate reaction was to like resist it a bit. And then he said the code word, stop resisting. And immediately I had like three other cops hitting me, putting knees on my back. My face hit the ground. I had a bloody nose. Eyes got black. I had a black eye. I had knots on my head. I had like my arm was practically like my tissue was torn open, or not torn open, but torn. And I could see later on, I can see a blood streak under my skin. To this day, I kind of still have pain when I do weightlifting. But basically, they beat me. They put me in the back seat. They went through everybody's information. They let them go. And they kept me in the back seat till after 10 o'clock. And then they booked me in for being out on the street past curfew. When they initially pulled us over, it was about 8 o'clock. And so we did nothing wrong. We did absolutely nothing. We weren't the perfect kids in the neighborhood. We were thugs. We were fighting and stuff like that. But that day was what Ice Cube, would say, it was a good day. But yet we got gangbanged on. And so I tell that story to say this, is even though as a young kid, I was like, F the police, screw the cops, don't be a snitch. I think it was after that incident that when I said F the police, I really meant it. And I knew from that moment on that I cannot trust the cops in anything. And so if anybody ever did dirt, or if anybody ever disrespected me or hurt my family or did something to me that was not good, I was not going to call the police, Scott. I was going to call my homeboys, because my homeboys would execute justice a lot quicker, and as well as a lot more passionately for me than the cops would. And so that was kind of the way, and I think a lot of youth grow up in that. They, maybe they're not the ones that got beat, but they're the ones connected to someone that got beat. Or maybe they've experienced a lot of police intimidation as they roll through the neighborhood and mad dog everybody, or police interrogation. So oftentimes people don't really, they don't really trust the police. You know,
the Bulldogs are an extremely violent gang. Most gangs are. They celebrate violence. So I found Ivan's take on violence really interesting as he looks at how the world of gangs kind of mirror, in a sense, the world of states as we use violence as a solution.
I mean, if you look at America in general, you pull away all of the political correctness and the stipulations of legality, what you'll end up seeing is that there's really no difference between the violence, the substance abuse, the cycles of murders that go on in the neighborhood, in contrast to those that go on militarily, or even in our criminal justice system. Like, it's all the same thing. The only difference is just that one is legal, the other one's illegal. And I see this because, in the neighborhood we say, I want respect. I shot this guy because he disrespected me, or he threatened my family or my friends. We do the same thing in our political systems. We say we're going to go drop a bomb on these people because they engaged an act of terror against us. We're going to drop a bomb on them and their family and their, it's just, as long as we define as a nation, as long as we define justice to be retributive and violent, people in the neighborhood are going to do the same. And the reason they're going to be taking it into their own hands is because they believe in the same kind of justice. The only thing is they don't feel like they trust conventional procedures. And so instead of, like me, instead of calling the police when I'm wrong, because I don't trust them, I'm going to call my friends. And I'm going to execute the same exact type of justice that America is executing in the Middle East, you know? I'm going to drop bombs. I'm going to get guns. Do the same exact thing.
Ivan talked about the days of Jim Crow segregation, where people had different housing, different bathrooms, even different drinking fountains for blacks and whites, and how that got carried over into the prison system and has become entrenched, such that it's a much thornier problem now in prisons than it is outside. We still struggle with various iterations of segregation and discrimination and separation here outside of prison, but inside prison, in the prison culture, it's been magnified. And so Ivan talks a little bit about the great challenge of the racialized prison system and how deeply entrenched racial segregation is in our institutions, in our state penitentiaries, in our corrections facilities.
Prison, prison is crazy. People always tell, this is interesting, people always say there is no institutionalized racism in America. They haven't visited prison. Here's the problem with prison, Scott. The problem with prison is that prison is as old as America is, right? Since the founding of this nation, people have been developing a system. I mean, I don't need to go into the history of all that. But what I would say is this, is that the culture of racial violence that exists in prison is rooted in the culture that was established during Jim Crow law. You literally have people that are still doing life in prison, Scott, who lived during Jim Crow. You know what I'm saying? Mm. And during Jim Crow, if society was segregated, can you imagine how segregated prisons were? And even though Jim Crow law was repealed, right? Even though it has been removed and decades have passed by, the culture that was established has grown into a Frankenstein monster in prison. It hasn't been removed. This is really interesting. In 2007, or I don't know if it was 2006 or 7, I was released in December of 2005, but I do remember that in my last year of incarceration, there was all these kind of hipster, liberal, who knows what people that were advocating for the incarcerated, you know, for incarcerated people in California. And one of the things that they were trying to do is they were trying to get a new policy to be put in place to integrate inmates cross-racially. And I just remember all the inmates were just shaking their head like, that is never going to work. Now, I'm not conservative, by the way. So I'm very postmodern, I guess, if you want to call me. If you want to put me under a label, put me under postmodern. But there's this very noble, like, really noble idea that, you know, if you just put these people together cross-culturally and cross-ethnically, they may and provide some classes, like it might actually work.
Wow. And that's I think this notion of people on the outside trying to make decisions for people on the inside without their voice mattering in the process.
Yes. And you know what? I just remember when I think it was not all prisons, but some of them like explored it. And so they started doing integrative housing at a level 2, I believe. It was either a level 2. I haven't really researched this. I'm just kind of speaking out of the stuff that I was exposed to in 2006. So I haven't really looked at this. But I think it was level 2s and level 1s or something like that. And the level 2s where they started practicing this integrated housing, it actually was reversed very quickly because inmates began to hurt each other pretty bad. And let me say, the problem is that the racial tension that exists in prison continues to be rooted in patterns from Jim Crow that were never resolved. So if during Jim Crow you had segregation that was taking place, after Jim Crow, that segregation continued. And when new inmates would arrive, they would have to assimilate to those patterns. And even though they left, the cultural patterns, those patterns were just became a part of the prison culture. And so when you go to, I just remember when I entered into this environment, it didn't matter whether you're a gang member or not. All that mattered was what city you were from and what your ethnicity was. And then they would put you with a gang that represented that region. And so I was an active gang member, so I had to be with my guys. But there was people that I knew were not active gang members that were forced into a certain gang sect just because of where they lived and the color of their skin. And eventually, of course, they become socialized in those patterns because it doesn't take very long either. Like, you can put a white guy with the Peckerwoods or the skinheads, and in about a year, they've kind of have been reprogrammed just because they have to live that way out of survival. You put an African American guy, there's no blood and Crips in prison either. They just come together and they leave the Bloods and Crips stuff out on the streets. It's really interesting. But with the Latinos, they remain very segregated from each other. But showers are racially segregated. Water fountains are racially segregated. Cells are racially segregated. Where you eat, I had a brother who came to Christ and he really loved our African American brothers. And he made a stance because he was white. The skinheads warned him to stop eating on the black side of the cafeteria. And he told them, sorry, but that's my Christian brother. And I will continue to eat with him, even if it offends you. And that same night, a younger skinhead who was trying to prove himself, he cut George's throat open in broad daylight and he just collapsed and died. So there's a lot of racism that, I mean, if you ask an officer, like, why they institutionalize racism in prison, they would say it's not necessarily institutionalized. It's under the category of, inmate safety. So it's come to the point now, and during Jim Crow, they intentionally segregated people racially, but the monster has been created, and now the system, though it would sometimes, I don't know if they would, I mean, systems don't have feelings, and oftentimes it helps them make a case for why they need more money, but even if the system tried to reverse the patterns of racism in prison, they would fail. And so now it's kind of like a reinforcing effect where they have to segregate in order to protect inmates. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's just like if you're white, they're not going to put you in a cell with a black man because you're just going to, you're going to get beat up. So they have to segregate you with white people. It's a big monster.
Ivan is pursuing his master's in theology and hopes to go on to enter a doctoral program. I found his take on evil and how the theological lens of evil affects how we see the inner city, the ways in which we categorize evil that comes out of the inner city versus evil that occurs in other places in society, that contrast becomes corrupted. We tend to hold up the inner city and those who are trapped in poverty as the pinnacle of depravity, as he calls it, without much self-reflection or looking at the ways in which depravity expresses itself in the suburbs or among the rich and his understanding, his theological understanding of how churches engage with the inner city, I thought was brilliant.
If you're an evangelical Christian and you're strong, like, you know, human nature is evil and this ontological view of human nature, what's really interesting is oftentimes that perspective intersects with the perspective of the police, so that you find evangelicals being really supportive of police endeavors in neighborhoods like mine. If you ask any event, if you ask a very strong, maybe even right-wing evangelical, like from Fresno, where do you see human depravity the most in your city? They would point to downtown Fresno. And if you ask a police officer, where are all the criminals in your city most likely located? They would say downtown Fresno. And then having that perspective as an evangelical, and then maybe even being influenced by this idea that we have a responsibility for the city, sometimes that combination is not very good. We find ourselves engaging the city under four postures. One, judgment. Two, assimilation. In other words, to disciple the people in my neighborhood means to make them productive citizens. Which if you're a thug like me, what you're going to feel is like, oh, shoot, they're trying to make me a sellout by becoming one with the police department, right? And then three, very evangelistic in the sense that, like, the poor become the object of evangelism because we embody depravity the most. And so everybody's church wants to come to my neighborhood to convert the masses, which oftentimes is not very helpful. And then lastly, sometimes our neighborhoods become objects in which churches can reflect the image of God through charitable work. So it has nothing to do with the people in the neighborhood at all. It has more to do with people's desire to want to look righteous. And I mean, how righteous can you look but if you work among the most wretched of the wretched, which is the poor, right? It's this self-contrasting against the poor that it's a terrible thing, man. But I think the church has to reconsider its anthropology, and it needs to look at it more biblically instead of just following the logic of certain traditions and just totally like declaring that all human nature is just fundamentally evil to the core. I think they need to reevaluate that, because what that does is it reinforces this stereotype against the poor, since we are often the ones who embody the characteristics of depravity in our cities. And so, I don't know, that's a little bit of my theological side coming out.
Yeah, no.
I'm not saying humans are fundamentally good either. We make a lot of we're all guilty. You know what I'm saying? Like, we are all struggling with the conditions of a broken relationship with God. But I think to say that inside the human being, like, they're just fundamentally evil, sounds great in theory, but in practice, that theory manifests itself in very unhealthy social ways. Like, we need to serve, but I think we need to put away these kind of superiority complexes away and start looking into the leadership that already exists. Because I'll tell you, Scott, the biggest organization that is having an impact in our inner cities is not the church, and it's not the police department. It's gangs. Gangs are controlling these streets. They're shaping the youth culture. They're strong. They're super strong. And the reason is because they get it. They understand the culture there. And they look and they build off of the leadership that already exists in the neighborhood. And so when we engage our inner cities or places where there's a lot of felony convicts or whatever you want to call them, like, we have to remember that leadership is already there. It's already there. It's just a matter of navigating our way and helping make some connections. I think that's what it's about, is making the connections between the leadership that exists and the kingdom of God. And so that's my role.
So I asked Ivan, what's it look like for people of privilege to really make a difference, those who really want to help but don't want to screw things up in the process. And he told me this really interesting story that sort of bookended this time as he opened by talking about that shame he felt in being helped by a family of privilege, and passing that through this redemptive lens. He kind of tells this story of another person of privilege wanting to help and how that turned out in a much more beautiful way.
I think sometimes what happens is like everybody wants to be the hero. And sometimes in the church, the hero looks more like a white person coming into the neighborhood, you know, lavishing a bunch of gifts and preaching the gospel. And I think we need to change that image. And we need to start thinking more about investing in the leaders that are already there. I have a really cool dentist, and my dentist is, you know, she loves hearing stories from the inner city. One of the things she did was like, she's like, I really want, it was Christmas, this past Christmas. She was like, I really want to help someone in the neighborhood. You know what I mean? And I helped her think through it. I was like, do you really want to be the person that walks into the house knowing that they're living in poverty and like throw a bunch of gifts at the family? And then she thought about it. She was like, no, I don't want to be that person. That's embarrassing. Well, what do I do? And I said, what about this? You know, I work with a bunch of young boys doing martial arts and stuff. And there's this one kid. So I'm just kind of painting the picture. But Edgar was having a hard time with his grades. So I had a talk with him about his grades. His mom was telling me, like, his grades are bad. So I had a talk with him and asked him, what's going on, bro? Like, your mom's telling me that your grades are suffering. And he said, yeah, things are hard. And the more I asked him questions, I discovered that what was really killing him inside was growing up with a deported father and also growing up in poverty. And that touched my heart because that was my story too. And so I helped him process through that. And then later on, a few days later, was when I met with my dentist. So my dentist is like, what do I do? What do I do? So I thought about Edgar and I said, you know what? How about you donate $200 or $400? Because she wanted to donate about that much. I mean, I don't normally get that arrogant or like, you know, that bold to ask someone to throw that much money. But she wanted to donate that much money. And so I said, why don't I sit down with Edgar and I tell Edgar, you're going to bring Christmas to your family this year as a man. You're going to provide dinner. You're going to take notes and get gifts for all of your siblings. And you're going to pray with your family and read the Christmas story from the Bible to them as a man taking this responsibility. I know this sounds a little patriarchal or whatever, but the reality is, you know, he's a Mexican boy growing up in a machista culture, and for him, what he really needs is to feel this sense of masculinity. And so I was just offering it, you know, in this creative way. And so I said, but you're gonna have to pay me back by working at the gym. You're gonna be cleaning up and breaking down for a couple of months. And so he, just when I told him what he thought about this opportunity, he broke down in tears. And so I coached him, not just through the physical fitness, but I coached him and what it means to be a leader to your family as a 16-year-old boy growing up in a single-parent home with his mom. And so my dentist had to humble herself. It didn't take much because she really loved the idea. But I did ask Edgar to write her a thank you. And at the end of the day, it wasn't a free gift. Edgar worked for it. In his mind, he worked for it. He's already completed his job, the job he owed us. But he was able to provide Christmas for his family. And I think when I was 15 years old, shoot, I told you that I felt ashamed standing in that line, or when the people came through this project giving us Christmas gifts, this white Christian family giving us a Christmas gift, I felt ashamed of myself. Edgar didn't have to go through that. He felt empowered. He felt so empowered, actually. did such a great job at in his little job that we ended up hiring him at our gym. So now he's involved in some of the maintenance projects. So,
in this podcast, I don't want to sanitize gangs or suggest that they are idyllic communities without any shortcomings. In fact, gangs are themselves communities of exclusion in which those in the so-called mainstream become the other. Gangs are like the fraternities of our inner cities. They are in some ways a response to marginalization, as if they're saying, hey, if we're going to be on the outside, if we're going to be labeled as other, then we're going to celebrate those things that offend the mainstream. You all are the other, and we are the gated community, gated by our violence and machismo and our own system of protection. Listening to Ivan has forced me to think more deeply about the violence of poverty, the violence of exclusion. If we're active in perpetuating underclasses, or best, if we're ambivalent toward classism and racism, we participate in the creation of gangs. We give fuel to the creation of exclusive communities in the inner city. At the same time, there are things about gangs that reveal true potential, potential for friendship and camaraderie and commitment and leadership. And we tend to be blind to those things when we see gangs as utterly wrecked by evil and in need of extermination rather than in need of redemption. All communities have things to celebrate and things to lament. And we tend to see the communities we're involved with as mainly things having qualities to celebrate, and gangs as mainly having things to lament and ought to be wiped off the face of the earth. We need to rethink how we're interacting with gangs, and Ivan has helped me to see some things, and I've appreciated his words of wisdom. I want to thank Ivan Paz for taking the time to be interviewed. I want to thank Skype for providing free services, albeit a bit choppy. And I want to thank Philip, my sound guy, for cleaning up all the foibles of poor recording equipment and free things like Skype. Feel free to comment, and we'll look forward to hearing from you, and tune in for the podcast next week.